Hello and good morning to you, Aman Handour. Welcome to Political Bark.
Good morning to you, Sophie.
It's
Good to
very
be here.
nice to have you with me here. I'm in Oslo, you are in Beirut. We are in very opposite parts of not only Europe but regions right now. How is the situation in Beirut? Just quickly.
Well, quickly, I mean, the short of it is wholesale collapse. So you have very briefly a country that is experiencing economic collapse, a banking collapse, a financial collapse as well, and all three are have their own dimensions, of course, and political collapse. So even if the if I mean, and the solutions are not really that complicated, but because the country's dysfunction has become truly debilitating for the last 3 years, ever since the crisis became apparent, because or visible, because in fact the country has been in crisis many longer years. You've seen the state and successive governments literally completely immobilized and paralyzed, unable to take the necessary decisions to take this very tiny country somewhere better for the future. So it's wholesale collapse, basically.
I mean, the last time I was in Lebanon, it was I think 6 years ago. And back then it was a nice place to visit, of course, with all of the differences that exist in Lebanon, the different communities, the religions, the tensions, the different groups. Of course, that's apparent, but I cannot even imagine what it's like right now. And personally, it's not somewhere you would think of going right now. I guess living there is difficult.
Well, it depends. It depends. I mean, and that's the bizarreness of Lebanon. That's always been the bizarreness of Lebanon. It depends on what geography you are in. If you are in the wealthy geographies, you're going to be practically oblivious to what is happening in the rest of the country.
Really?
Very easily oblivious. Absolutely. And that's something that you will immediately feel when you come to Lebanon. We have our parties, our galas, our fun, the beaches, the clubs, the cafes. In the geographies of wealth, you could, if you wanted to insulate yourself completely, or if you, let's say, if you really didn't care two bits, well, that's very easy, really. But in the geographies of, let's say, the middle class, and certainly the poorer sections of society, of course, the panorama is starkly different. This is a country that the United Nations and the World Bank have declared impoverished. 80% of the population now is either poor or seriously, severely poor. There is, I mean, the savings of the populace have been completely wiped out. They don't have even access to whatever remains, according to the different exchange rates that are, again, bizarrely produced by the central bank and the government's refusal to devalue the lira. We've got now four or five exchange rates literally in the country. So if you go to these geographies, if you have a business to, if you care two bits, if you want to know, it becomes an extraordinarily painful and
Experience.
heartbreaking experience. And we've just seen over the past 2 weeks, if you recall, that there were I think over 90 people who died trying to escape Lebanon from the shores of Tripoli, to other places that might give them a better chance at a decent life. So again, it depends on where you are, but that doesn't change. I mean, to be very clear, that doesn't change the reality of the wholesale collapse. It just means that there are certain sections of society who could simply ignore it because they've got the wealth, because they have the opportunity. That's all. That's all that it means. They can stay in their bubble, but
Yes,
it is a bubble,
of course.
right?
I think that's having lived in a couple of countries, Arab countries, Middle East, Muslim countries, I've seen that even in a time of less crisis, much less crisis than Lebanon today, it is possible, always possible, to live in a bubble, and you often do so when you are a foreigner living, expat. You live in a bubble where you see these extreme differences between populations and local populations, and what you're doing and what a small portion of society is doing. So, I mean, what you're experiencing is the extreme case, but I do remember this feeling from all countries I've lived in the Middle East.
I mean, that's a very good observation, Sophie. I mean, and that's what gives many of us such comfort when we are in the Middle East. This ability to create, first of all, to create your own bubble, and to live in it as if it's your own country, completely separate
Yes. But
from outside reality.
it's quite harsh though, because once you step out of it occasionally and you see what is really going on, perhaps living in Egypt, I was living in Cairo. Once I stepped out of the fancy neighborhoods and saw the millions of poor people, not in a time of crisis, I mean, that's different. You realize that it's quite hard to live in a country with such stark, star st strong differences between populations, especially, compared to Norway, where everyone is more or less the same.
Of course, of course. But
But
again, I mean, frankly, that's a feature of modern Arab life.
yes,
You
I know.
see it in Egypt, you see it in Jordan. You saw it in Syria before the civil war. You see it now.
Yes.
It's clearly a distinctive feature of life in Lebanon. And as I told you, in Lebanon, of course, and you've just mentioned this, it's taken to an extreme level because in my neighborhood, in my zone of life, friends, work environment, area of activity, I can pretty much live there as if I'm living in a separate country altogether, right? So something was were to happen literally 15 minutes away from me, it's like another country. If it were to happen in the deep south or up north, it's like another planet.
It's
You just ignore it. And that's of course there shouldn't be anything reassuring about this. It's an extremely sad portrait of a country. But that's how many of us here choose to survive. I don't do that, but many of us do, certainly.
Because you are a writer and you have published several books, and you are now about to publish the last one, which is This Arab Life: A Generation's Journey into Silence, which is part a memoir and part a historical narrative. Can you please first explain how long you've been writing for, and how long you've been a writer, and then a bit about this part memoir, part historical narrative. I think it's an interesting way to
Sure.
write.
Well, I should have been writing for a very long time now. If I had acted on my passion, I would have probably been at it now for, over 30 years. But when I finished my master's, I decided to embark on a corporate career
Of
for many
course.
reasons. I mean, it was disappointment with politics. There was an aversion to this kind of, public engagement. That goes also to some aspects of the latest book. So what happened is as I embarked on a career in research and communication, and then I decided finally in 2002 that I could afford. First of all, I felt that I was ready to shift my focus, and I was ready to really give much more attention to writing. And that's what happened in 2002. I lost a very dear friend, Ali Jabri, who was perhaps one of the region's most talented painters. And he lived the kind of life and came from the kind of family that lent themselves to a very different approach to the modern history of the Arab world. So when he died, I decided that this is going to be my first project. So I wrote a kind of memoir about him, but in actual fact, it was a historical narrative. And I tend to do this. I don't know of any other book in the Arab world that wove an historical narrative through the life and art of an Arab artist. So I decided that this is an angle, a perspective that adds to the archive of work on the Middle East in an interesting way. And that's what I did. And then I was blogging for many years, very much engaged in social media. And in 2016, for a number of reasons, decided to step back and withdraw. And it was at that time, of course, this is post-Arab uprisings. It's also post a very painful family tragedy for me. I decided to go very quiet and sit back and see if in fact there was a new book in me. So I sat down in, I would say, 2018, and I didn't really decide at that time that I was going to write a book. I decided at that time that I want to achieve clarity. There were incessant questions nagging at me. And I'm the kind of writer who writes for clarity. I don't achieve clarity and then sit down to present it. I actually write in order to understand. And that's what I did. And at the end of the journey, it seemed to me that I had put together an interesting book that needed to come out. I sent it out, of course, to various circles of readers in order to see if this book actually resonates. And fortunately, it did. And that's when I decided to run with it. So that's the short of it, really, when it comes to this Arab life and also to my writing career. I have a blog again now. It's called This Arab Life, and I have become much more of an active writer again. So I expect that that's be the case for quite a few years to come, hopefully.
Great. And have you always known that you wanted to write? Or I mean, for me, for example, as a podcaster, I write a lot in Norwegian newspapers about politics and international politics. For me, it's what I love doing. It's what I love. It's what gives me joy. Writing and discussing and debating, etc. For you, have you always, I'm curious to know with writers, have you always felt this need or this want or this desire to put everything into on paper and tell stories, sort of?
I have, and truthfully, I really shouldn't have resisted that passion and that desire. I shouldn't have. But again, there's no sense in regretting such decisions in one's life. It's a futile exercise, really. But if you were to ask me, should you have started earlier? Yes, absolutely. But at that time, I decided that I wanted to move in another trajectory, really. And it goes also to the heart of this Arab life and what it's about. And final analysis, it's about, my generation, which is the generation that came of political age in the 1980s. And it was the decade, frankly, when a jarring contrast between the chronic turbulence of the region and a people bearing witness to it in silence. So I suppose in that way, my silence as an individual, as a writer, was of a piece with that kind of larger silence. Mm-hmm. I'd always been extremely passionate about politics. That's what I'd studied at Georgetown and Stanford. Mm-hmm. I'm a student of history. I'm a student of politics. I'm constantly engaged in it. And I suppose I decided to shy away from the writing career because what I wanted to write about was, the cause of much of my disaffection and disappointment. Mm. And it was a certain kind of, disgust that I don't want to have to do anything with this. I'm just going to, and that's what happened to my generation, frankly. I'm just going to focus on myself. I'm going to focus on my financial state of affairs. I'm going to have a successful career. I'm going to make it. I'm going to be very pragmatic.
Protective.
I'm going to be focused on my future.
Yeah.
And that's what we're advised to do, frankly, as a generation, and very specifically the privileged class within this generation.
Yes, yes.
Because that's what the book alludes to as well. It holds a mirror to myself and my class, and ask some very hard questions. And one of the questions is, of course, why the silence?
Right.
Because that's when it starts.
Yeah.
So I suppose in that sense, you see this kind of individual silence as a reflection of a much larger one.
Yeah.
I guess it took a bit of wisdom and maturity for me to understand that perhaps the writing itself would give me a certain kind of reward and satisfaction and clarity. And again, helped me confront some very difficult issues that in the past I had decided to just...
Because the silence that you experienced and the generational silence, it at some point it clashes with ethical and moral values, if you allow it to.
Of course, especially for the elite.
Exactly.
Especially for them.
Exactly, because it's, I've seen it firsthand in the region.
Well, you see, when you are living in despotic regimes, when you're living in an oppressive setting, it kind of makes you lazy, right? It helps you find all the excuses you need to excuse yourself from the scene, equally from asking the very difficult questions. And what I do in this book is say that we as the elites were part of this history. We had a place in it, we had a role in it. And there's no reckoning, there's no laundry list of grievances, there's no allocation of blame, there's just the attempt as honestly as possible to understand what role we played and why. And it seemed to me that since we were the elites and since we were part of this history, you couldn't possibly let the moment pass without asking some very difficult questions.
No.
It's not, and didn't necessarily find the answers. Not every excavation process leads to revelations, right? But you have to ask the questions all the same. You have to ask the very hard questions and see and have a better understanding what your role was, what your place was, what could you have done, what could you not have done. Because in Tyrannese, it's very easy for you to sit back and say, well, I couldn't do anything. It's just very easy. It allows you to be this lazy, and it allows you to be the victim.
But do you think today in with the current situation in Lebanon, do you think, I mean, I assume this book has been written, so first in English, French, and Arab, or,
I mean, it's been written in English, it will be hopefully translated into Arabic. Mm. If a French publisher is interested, by all means, I'm very happy to do that.
Because,
but for the moment, it's English, and then perhaps Arab.
Yeah, because I was thinking, because what you're doing is that you're basically I don't know if it's a soft or a hard way, direct or indirect way, explaining a bit the behavior from the outside that many people of that generation have had and still have. So the question is then, are they interested in hearing right now with all of the other problems going on? Because as you said, in the 80s, one would go into this sort of self-protective way of thinking, of living, that resulted actually in what we also see today. You live your life in a bubble and you separate yourself from the reality around you. So do you think that the different classes, or especially one class, for example, would be interested in hearing what you say and actually being able to digest the truth of perhaps what they are in some way?
If you were to ask me my guess, because the book is going to be coming out, mm-hmm. I suspect that a certain small cohort mm-hmm. would be very much interested, and they are probably like-minded. They are what you call, or what they probably like to call themselves, because that's what we call ourselves, the sensitized duality, right? Mm-hmm. Those who know, those who care, those who have a very awareness of what's going on, and mm-hmm. are probably asking themselves some very serious questions, because you don't arrive at this kind of catastrophic moment in the Arab world without finding absolutely imperative to ask a very tough question. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I tell you, I am expecting, mm-hmm. and hopefully I'm wrong, who knows, I'm expecting that I am burning quite a few bridges.
Of course.
With this book. Not too many people, you know, human beings are not really very good at the hard truth, right?
Yeah.
It takes, I mean, even in, forget even about politics or this kind of, you know, this kind of approach to therapy, even in private therapy, really, and you can think of the book as a kind of therapy, really. But even in private therapy, it takes quite a bit for you to dig in and to be very honest with yourself and come face with some very uncomfortable or ugly truths. And that's just on a private level. So on a public level, I can imagine that many in my class have already perhaps reflexively come up with their own answers and are feeling very comfortable with those. Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, the comfortable of it all, to be comfortable right now, it's more interesting than being, you know, dissecting what are my moral flaws and what have I done that I shouldn't have done, perhaps. But I mean, the problem is that as long as that's not, of course, but as long as that's not being done, especially in the region of the Middle East, the Arab countries, there's going to be no change whatsoever. Because I mean, in order to build a movement, for example, to create political change, to create, let's say, more of an equal society, not democracy, because it's very far away, then the elite, or let's say these parts of society, have to say, no, we are not okay with this. We are not okay with just being comfortable, and et cetera, et cetera. But it's a huge question that you're opening up in your book, and it's a very brave topic to speak about, and hence I see A Generation's Journey into Silence, hence the title also, because it's, when you hear it like this, you could imagine that someone was silenced from the outside by, let's say, an oppressive regime, but here it's self silencing in many ways, or choosing ignorance, yes. Choosing ignorance and bliss over reality.
Not even ignorance. You could have very well been aware, and I don't think many in my class were really that oblivious. I mean, look, in countries like Jordan and Lebanon and other places, it's not really very difficult to know what's going on around you, really. I mean, you have to be completely switched off to be ignorant of what's going on around you. And I suspect that many of us knew. And that's what makes the questions even harder to ask, because many of us knew. We were aware. We saw. And we chose, for many reasons, again, no allocation of blame. We chose for many reasons Some of them external to us, some of them internal to us, some of them in the history of our of the older generations, our older siblings, our parents, even our grandparents, and the failure of successive Arab generations to have a say in the shape of our life, in the shape of our political systems, in our choice of social structures, our relations with the international community, and you know, when it came to my generation, it was really kind of almost a perfect moment for silence, because we had practically depleted all avenues and all efforts, from the grand ideologies to the grand political parties, to the activism on the ground, ending of course in the late 60s and early 70s with the student revolts and sit-ins and strikes and mass disobedience campaigns that failed as well. In the context of the emergence of increasingly repressive regimes that were morphing into police states. So it's a certain kind of, it's a different kind of despotism than the old style dictatorship. So you could see a blend of contempt, a blend of helplessness, a blend of shock and trauma, leading to, well, if there's nothing much I can do about it. I mean, if in the aftermath of the 1967 war, which was truly, truly, I mean, a change maker in the Middle East. I mean, it is a cataclysmic, it was a cataclysmic event. And not a single regime came down, not a single one. So in full view of this, it's very easy to understand why my generation, which came into adulthood in the 1980s, early adulthood and became of political age, would just say, okay, well then, let's just focus on ourselves and see what we can do for ourselves. Because clearly, doing something, the larger thing is not on the table.
It's not possible. It's not even, yeah.
Right.
But I mean, I was just in Tunisia, recently in Tunisia, and you know, they say it's one of the most democratic liberal countries of the region, etc. And you see women, they can wear whatever they want. I was a bit surprised coming, having lived in Egypt, where you cover up much more as a woman, seeing women wear whatever skirts, what they want to wear in summer. But the thing is, the interesting thing is that that's just such a Western way to think, oh, it's a liberal country. Because when you scratch the surface of Tunisia today, after the revolution just a couple of years ago, you see that things have just gotten worse, actually, in so many ways. As my Tunisian friends say, they say before, we power used to be in one hand, sort of a totalitarian strict. Now power is it's given to many hands. Again, I think then, you know, they speak about this elite, rich elite that has strong connections, and is dictated in that way. So it's worse in many ways. And again, the same notion that these people that could do something to, and that perhaps also had a greater chance after the Arab Spring of changing, of bringing in real democracy, as we call it in the West, they haven't done so. They have, again, failed themselves and their own country. So I guess perhaps it's in some way a bit of the same experience that you are describing in A Generation's Journey into Silence, just that it's in real time.
Well, yeah, and it comes for this new generation. I mean,
exactly.
Exactly. There's a different generation that came down, that erupted in the 2011 uprisings, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is the generation that came of political age again in the aughts and the early 2010s. So this one is experiencing its own trauma now, and its own children are going to rise to feel contempt for them as well.
Yeah, but I mean, with everything going on now internationally, the war, the economy, I mean, the predictions are extremely negative for any, I'm sorry to say, I really believe that there's not going to be any positive let's say, equalizing or liberal trends in the Middle East next years.
No, none,
I think it's going
none.
to be so
Very
hard.
difficult. One wants to be humble in the prediction business. But I think it is relatively safe to say that we are on a terrible trajectory. Not everywhere in the Middle East. Let's be very clear. We need to be sensitive to the peculiarities of each country, its own historical context and politics. But certainly in my area, in the Levant, in the Fertile Crescent, Iraq, the Palestinian territories, Lebanon, Jordan, certainly Libya, and North Africa, Sudan, which I think is a very interesting country and people don't give it enough attention. The trajectory is not reassuring. It
No.
isn't, to varying degrees and for different reasons, but not reassuring, no.
Especially for those sort of soft elements of society that in the end make up the whole. No, so this book, I haven't read it. It hasn't come out yet, but
It's actually available on all platforms now.
Oh, it
The
is
official
available
release is October
on
11, but it's
Amazon.
available on all platforms.
Okay, so it's
Amazon, Barnes & Noble,
okay,
you can go to your local
great.
bookstore and order it,
Great, great,
certainly.
great. This is a book that falls sort of, as I see from the outside, in between a scholarly analysis of the past and today, with because you are a not you're are you a
I
political
would I
scientist?
mean Scholarly is, I think, I certainly hope I was not, when you say scholarly, it tends to give the impression of being rather, rigid
Yeah, no, that it's factful.
and dry.
But the
It's in that sense, it isn't. But what it does do, and you're absolutely right, it infuses the book with the sources, with the authors, with the analysts, with the observers on whom I regularly depend to help me understand the Arab world. So here and there you will see them present on the page, correct. But it's not a scholarly effort in the sense, in the traditional sense. It isn't, no.
So if I'm curious then, or if I'm a listener of Political Bark and I want to understand more of the situation today, the reasons for the things, how things are today in societies and in Lebanon then first and foremost, and
The
also
book for you.
a really an insider's perspective of a truthful story. Because you're not on anyone's side, you're not on the politician's side, you're not on the government, you're not on the elite, you're not on the you're basically
I'm a
an
loner.
outsider inside your own country trying to tell to in a fair way say what you see. So I think that's perhaps what would really attract me to the book, that it gives me it opens up brand new ways of understanding, and also
Well, I mean, and it's a native voice, right? It's a native voice. I didn't want to be, I've long been written about as an Arab and as a Levantine. I didn't want to be written about anymore. I didn't want to, let's put it this way. I didn't want to read what is being written about me anymore. I wanted to move myself
Right.
from the margin, from the edge of the historical discourse and political discourse to the center of it, or closer to the center of it, if you like. I thought it was important that I offered this kind of intimate perspective from my own lived experience, from my own history and the history of my generation.